On this episode of Skeptico, Los Angeles medium Marcel Cairo on how science's skepticism of the paranormal remains a battle between science and religion.
You know, we're getting caught up in the intricacies of psi research when really what's going on is a battle between creationism and evolution.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode, we're going to dip into a subject that I've been wanting to cover for quite some time. It has a lot of interest to me, and I think to many of you out there from the emails that I've received, and that's the subject of medium research and research on psychics. We're going to start our journey into this topic in a slightly unusual way. Marcel Cairo, who is a friend of mine and is also a practicing medium in the Los Angeles area, contacted me recently and asked me to be a guest on his show, Afterlife FM. I suggested to him that why doesn't he let me interview him on Afterlife FM and that I would then use that same interview on Skeptico. So that's what we did. So this is an interview that has appeared on Afterlife FM a couple weeks ago, but I thought for those of you who didn't catch it on Afterlife FM or aren't familiar with his show, I'd play it for you here on Skeptico. So here goes my very interesting chat with Marcel Cairo. You know, I was going to start by saying that it's a real kind of unique situation, but it's also a pleasure to interview you. You know, I first met you through Skeptico, and you took an interest in the show, and we got to know each other, and then I got to meet your family, and we became friends, which is really kind of neat, because being a psychic, I really didn't get a chance to know you as a psychic. I just got to know you as a normal person, a real guy. And I thought that would be kind of an interesting way to start this interview. And that's to, rather than to focus on you as a medium, as a psychic, but just maybe you'd want to tell folks a little bit about who you are, just the normal kind of stuff that people are interested in.
Well, that's a good way to start. Well, first of all, just to go back to what you said, I want to thank you for that. But I also make a distinction. I rarely, if ever, call myself a psychic, because I think that definitely means something in today's society, and I tend to more steer towards the mediumship part, where instead of me using any kind of clairvoyant or clairaudient kind of skill or ability to perceive things, I use more the mediumship, where I actually am between two worlds, so to speak, between the conscious world of the discarnate and the conscious world of the incarnate. So just want to clarify that a little bit, because I kind of steer away from the psychic stuff. But to go back to your question, I don't really spend all my day, you know, doing, you know, psychic medium work or talking about consciousness, although it seems like it lately. I am also trained, university trained, in marketing and in film, and a lot of my time is spent either freelancing in that world or fantasizing about what I'd like to do if I had my druthers in that world. And I have aspirations, you know, as a screenwriter, and I also have aspirations, you know, as kind of a creative director. So a lot of my daily interaction with people is, you know, either talking about marketing or I actually have a project that could potentially take off here soon, which is in the world of film as a screenwriter. So having an active imagination helps in the mediumship work, because there's a lot of decoding, I guess, of images and information that you get. And I think that having a creative mind is beneficial to that degree. But I also am a father and a husband, and I thoroughly enjoy that part of my life, especially the father part, because my children have allowed me to act as silly and as foolish as I usually do, but at least now people can say, oh, maybe it's because he's got these two young kids and he's not really that crazy. So,
right.
So that's kind of, I don't know if that kind of answers you, gives you a scope.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that was well said. And actually, you've kind of led me into the next topic that I wanted to talk about, because when you started out drawing out the distinction that you make between psychics and mediums, I have to say that from a scientific perspective, that always just frustrates me a little bit, because it seems like it's jumping about three steps ahead of the story. I mean, here we are trying to battle just the basic notion that any of these capabilities are within the human capability, within the human realm of being capable. And then secondly, establishing whether or not, you know, science should look at these things. And then here we are with someone like you who says, oh, no, wait, we have to distinguish between, you know, psychokinesis and psychics and mediums and intermediaries. And no, there's nothing wrong with that. I understand that's the world that you live in every day. But I think for the layperson, and I try not to get into that too much because I like to kind of hold back at that question of the scientific evidence for that. Here's the question. Why do you think that capability that you have, however you want to talk about it, has been so difficult to capture from a scientific perspective?
Well, and I don't know how scientific or astute my argument is going to be, but I will tell you something that I think a lot of people have used as a kind of a reference point, and I myself have used it as well, is that it's the same as if science were put in charge to define and predict and somehow use genetic mapping to talk about love. There has to be at some point an objective reality where the scientific method is, you know, always the best, the safest bet to go to, you know, to make distinctions. And then there's got to be subjective reality, which where I would include love or even the opposite end of that scale, hate or something like that, where science really can only approximate some kind of prediction or some kind of theory, but can never really fully experience. I don't think.
See, but do you really believe that,
Marcel?
Is
there anything that's come out in science so far that could have somehow gauged that you would fall in love and marry who you did, or that I would fall in love and marry who I did, and why it wasn't the other people who we also felt an intimate and a strong connection to that we could have possibly fallen in love with and married? But
yeah, but that's a different question. I mean, the question I have, and that kind of led into another thing, I believe, and I think in talking to you, you share this belief that we haven't really constructed experiments that specifically look at establishing this phenomena in a scientific way. You know, I mean, you and I talked recently because, you know, I'm interviewing James Randi upcoming. And of course, he's famous for the $1 million challenge kind of thing. Well, you know, no one wants to go ahead and set something up specifically to address a rather silly kind of challenge like that. But maybe we should. I mean, maybe all the effort should go into specifically designing some little test that would maybe in a small way, but would firmly establish the legitimacy of gathering that information outside of the five normal senses.
I'm 100% for that. And then you and I have spoken briefly about that and different ideas that we both have shared. But again, I've always been thinking about this lately. If Dean Radin and Rupert Sheldrake and all the other people who have done psi experiments and Dr. Gary Schwartz, who've done psi experiments in controlled situations and done their best at double blind and triple blind, and not even they can get the scientific community to even entertain the possibility that this is worthy of research, then I really, in all honesty, as much as I would like to believe that I could somehow, you know, in cooperation with other scientists and skeptics, be able to participate in something that would get them to say, hey, wait a second, consciousness survival studies is worth our attention. I've now come to the conclusion that although it may be entertaining and it may get, you know, PR and media attention if it's done well and it's publicized well, but I just don't know. I mean,
I hear you. But don't we have to, in whatever small way we can, push that rock up the hill. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to, because someone is going to eventually be the one who pushes it over the top. And then, you know, I'd go back to a conversation I had with Dean Radin, who you just mentioned a minute ago. And I think he had a tremendous insight into how these things change. And his insight was, you know what happens? What happens is it changes overnight, and then everyone says, oh, yeah, well, of course, I always knew that telepathy and some kind of psychic abilities were real. Of course I always did. So it just switches overnight. And I think that's how paradigms change. They don't change by this gradual thing. And no one knows where the breakthrough is going to come. I think when we had a conversation just the other day, it was on your show that I listened to last night. I think you had a great quote in there from Michael Shermer. And I think he's totally right, where he said, you know, it's going to take a Charles Darwin type of person that combines a right person at the right time to really make the difference.
Well, now, I titled this episode of Afterlife FM Consciousness Cowboys. And although there's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, in some sense, I do believe that both you and I, although we come from a different angle to the subject, are these consciousness cowboys, where we're not really scientifically trained by university, but our interest and our passion for the subject is so strong that I think, and there are plenty of other people like us out there, that this community of consciousness cowboys and cowgirls will in some way maybe be the push that what you're talking about requires. I'll say this right now. If opensourcescience.net or Skeptico is able to work together with the believer or the psi community and the skeptical community and create a forum where they can actually do collaborative work, and they want to, you know, have a volunteer or some kind of medium like myself who's able to help construct the experiments, I will volunteer. I'll gladly be there, because I really do want the same things that you do and the other people that listen to your show want. Whatever the results be, whether it says, Marcel, you're a complete idiot, you're delusionary, you know, delusional and whatever, or if it says, you know what, there's actually something here, anomalous information that cannot be explained either through cold reading, hot reading, chance or whatever, and that it doesn't prove anything per se as far as it absolutely being a survival consciousness, but it does say, wait a second, this deserves our attention. I will volunteer. I'll do it, Alex. I just don't know whether you are going to succeed in opensourcescience.net to get the other side to come halfway.
I know, and you're right. But we will try, and we will push forward, and that's a very brave offer, but I don't think it seems that brave to you, because I know that you live it every day. And I was also going to relate here on this show that, you know, as part of getting to know you and becoming friends and knowing your family, you know, we never did a reading. That is, you never did a psychic reading for me. But then a couple of weeks ago, we got to the point and I said, hey, Marcel, there's this issue that I'm going to investigate, a health issue inside of my family, and I'm going to take it from kind of a semi-scientific way. But as part of that, I want to get multiple readings from multiple different psychics. And you were a little reluctant at first, but then jumped in and didn't even give a full reading, but gave me a partial reading, and it was just incredible. I mean, you were the information that you give, and again, I was holding back everything, not giving you any clues as to what the condition might be, and you just narrowed right in on it, and it was rather not an obvious thing that you'd guess, like heart or anything else, and it was interesting that you would kind of confirm for me that these are just talents that you have, and they are quite real. And in a small way, you proved that to me. I wonder though, one of the parts of that reading that was so interesting to me, and I thought very honest and open on your part, is your admission that you really don't know how it works. You don't know how it works for yourself. And I thought you might talk for a minute about that too, because I think sometimes, you know, people think that folks like you with this gift, this ability, whatever you want to call it, have complete knowledge or complete control over this ability. So do you want to talk to that for a minute?
Okay, I'd like to talk about that. I think one thing that has enabled me to achieve a certain level of professionalism. That's what I'm going to call it, you know, because I don't want to say expertise at all. I want to say professionalism and how I conduct my mediumship relationship with clients and other people that I see, is the fact that I surrender completely to that knowledge, that I have absolutely no control over it. I don't make any requests of spirit. I try, you know, as much as I can to make sure that I don't have any communication with the people that I see, because I realize that what's needed to do the job properly is a complete, at least as much as one can, you know, without being a Buddhist, as release of one's own ego, and also objectivity in the circumstances. Like, that's why a lot of times doing readings for your own family or friends is very difficult, and I totally avoid it as much as I can. That's why, you know, you and I had become friends and we started talking, and I got a little bit kind of nervous about the fact that, you know, I don't know if I can even do a reading for you anymore, because we've lost some objectivity in our relationship, and I don't want to you know, jeopardize that friendship or in any kind of way by doing a reading which somehow ends up being just so awful, like, you know, we both are embarrassed by it. So by not knowing, I forgot which one of the sages of time says, you know, the ignorance is bliss or whatever it is, but in the case of mediumship, it truly is. You don't want to know anything, not only about the process, but about the people. And that gives you, that opens the door, because you're going in without assumptions. You're going in without kind of, because there's no way to remove yourself completely as a human, you know, moving your own kind of critical analytical mind out of the picture. You just move it to the side as much as you can, and you're hoping that, you know, it doesn't interfere with the rest of it. So I don't know if that answers your question or even gets near what you were asking me, but if not, you can just redirect me. I'll try again.
No, I think it does. But at the same time, it brings up another point that's always kind of gnawed at me, and that's the cold reading aspect to it. Now, you know, so you have this ability, and like I say, from our brief encounter, I do believe that you have some talents. I am very, very persuaded by all of the evidence out there that there are some people that have this talents, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of that evidence that seems particularly convincing to me. But one of the things that just really gnaws away at me is, why are so many readings, even from people who, let's say, do have this ability, they wound up sounding just like the fake readings that people do? I mean, people are, and it could have happened before, it could have happened after, it's the name of this, or it's a name begins with M, or maybe it's L. And I'm exaggerating here, but there is that aspect that comes through, I think, even in the best readings.
The comparison I like to make is, you know, going back to World War II and in the science of cryptography, where they're trying to decode the different, you know, German or Japanese codes. And there's a whole room of cryptographers there reading, you know, these messages that are coming through that they're picking up. And they kind of keep having to test it. And there's failure after failure after failure after failure in some senses, in some ways, until eventually, using the same code that you're getting and, you know, approaching it from a different kind of decoding perspective, you eventually start to see a pattern develop, and you eventually start to say, we broke the code. So it's not to justify the cold reading aspect of some readings, and I think one of the reasons that there are these aspects is because we're humans in some ways, and we are, and there are these, like, either body language kind of cues that people give off, or gestures or sighs or whatever, and as much as you try to pretend like you didn't hear it or see it, or even the eye roll or whatever it is that you might have seen, you're affected by it. And sometimes I have to turn myself around from my client, because there are some people that you read for who are either, they just give away too much in the way that you, in when you're, you know, talking to them, and their responses or in their body language, and so no matter how hard I try, you know, unless I'm completely partitioned and blinded and sealed off from them, I cannot not be affected by some of their actions. And so you start to double back on some things you say sometimes, because you might have picked up a cue from them that made you start, you know, having self-doubt, which is you jumping back in, it's your own ego jumping back into the reading. And when you let your own ego jump back into the reading, and there's a desire by almost all humans to want to be perfect or want to be right. So, accepting, you know, not being right is very important also in the process. So for myself, I can only answer for myself, to do a double blind or a triple blind kind of a test or experiment with mediumship, I'm all for it. But I also know, and like I expressed to you the other day, for some reason there is a need, no matter at what level, to be able to focus or at least concentrate on the person you're doing a reading for. And so there needs to be some kind of connection. And I liken it to like a transistor radio and a battery, that, you know, the battery alone and the transistor radio alone can't give you music. But when you put them together and you turn it on, it works. So that's the only thing that I can say as far as, no, I don't have to see the person. I don't have to hear the person. I don't have to know the person. But I have to have at least something that lets me imagine that single person or lets me know, you know, that person sitting in a chair or whatever, that I can zero in my focus.
Well, that's interesting on a couple of different levels. I think the analogy of the cryptographer is really interesting, and it's enlightening for me because I can really visualize that, even though I have absolutely, to my knowledge, no abilities whatsoever in this way.
I see myself as a cryptographer, truly a cryptographer, because I get this, and a lot of times the information is clear right away, and then all of a sudden you're getting this kind of language that's kind of like pictographic, and I'm like, okay, it's vague, and I see the image, it's vague, and now I have to kind of say, well, does this mean this, Avenue A, or does it mean Avenue B? You know, and there's a choice as a medium, as a person, that I have to make. And sometimes I go down Avenue A, and then into it I realize, you know what, I should have gone down Avenue B. And I acknowledge it, go, you know what, there, I chose the wrong path, but I'm still seeing the same image.
Well, you know, that's an interesting kind of lead into something I wanted to ask you about, the research that has been done with mediums, and probably the most well-known, the most well-documented, is that of Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona. And I know you're familiar with some of his work. And I thought one aspect of that I think is really fascinating for folks who listen to Skeptico and, like me, like to kind of dig past the soundbite the summaries that you sometimes get of this work. And that's that if you look at this guy's work, he directly sought to kind of address what we're talking about here in terms of the cold reading. So he said, okay, understand the cold reading stuff is out there. And, you know, I've spoken with Gary Schwartz. I've never been able to have a full interview with him on the phone, but I've spoken with him a couple times about these topics. And he's very, very open. If you ever listen to him, he's very easy guy to talk to. And of course, extremely, extremely intelligent, you know, very well credentialed. But he actually took classes in cold reading so that he could kind of eliminate that from his work. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is you would think that somebody who sets out to specifically address the cold reading problem, and it's pretty easy to do, right? He says, okay, there isn't going to be, first of all, we're going to put a screen so you can't see that body language stuff that you talked about. We're going to put a screen between the two people. And then second, the only answers we're going to be allowed to give are yes or no answers. And those answers, we're not even going to worry about the tonality of someone's voice. We're going to have the answers come through an intermediary. Now, before we get on to saying how, you know, the uber skeptics then still attack that as not being enough, what do you think in general of that work, and what do you think of, do you think that's sufficient to overcome the cold reading aspect of what can go on between someone who's sitting for a reading and a medium?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. I don't think it's enough to overcome, because just in the last few months, didn't he come out with a triple blind study test where he addressed even more of those criticisms, you know, like a sound chamber room and like obscured all.
Yeah, but he did. But I just think to me, to a certain extent, it's just playing on the other guy's field. I mean, you know, we have to apply common sense here at some point. And if the major criticism of a reading between a medium and a sitter is cold reading, which means I'm going to ask you questions, or I'm going to give you these vague answers that, you know, it could have happened before or now or after, so it kind of covers all the bases. If I take that out of the formula, If I take that out of the mix where that can't happen, and then if I take, okay, there could be nonverbal communication, which I think is really weak. No one's ever proven that, you know, a body shift here or a scratch of the head there could communicate the name of your deceased grandmother. I mean, that's really far-fetched. But if in addition you take that out of the mix, I just think that that completely covers it for me. But yeah, he did go to a triple blind.
Let me talk about the real issue here, because you know, we're getting caught up in the intricacies of psi research when really what's going on is a battle between creationism and evolution. Because even
I agree.
This is all this is about. If there were a law on the on the books, a constitutional law says we will not allow the teaching of creationism or anything other than evolution in our schools, then that debate and that fight would be, you know, be quelled. And we'd be talking about, we'd be able to confront skeptics and scientists and say, okay, now we've moved out of the evolution creationism fight or intelligent design fight. Let's look at consciousness seriously. Until that fire has been put out, I don't think psi research has anywhere to go. I truly don't.
I agree with the spirit of that, and I definitely think it's a science versus religion. I don't know if I'd pare it down all the way to evolution versus creation. But I think I completely agree. And it's so funny that when you talk to people and say, isn't this really a religious debate? Isn't this really a question of, you know, science versus religion? And so many times people insist, no, it's really not. And I think you're right. I think that is at the
core.
Because
a lot of people can't separate spirituality from religion, because to acknowledge a spiritual self that is somehow beyond the neurobiological synapses of the brain that says beyond those basic genetic needs and imprinting that goes on in the brain, there's something, a spiritual self. I think they equate that with religion. And again, until that battle is somehow calmed down or at least pushed to the side, you know, no one's going to really, from that field, from that group, is going to really look at consciousness in a way that would allow them to break that paradigm.
I again would have to agree with you, and yet we have to kind of push forward, and because that science versus religion debate, you can go only so far there, you know. And I think you have to also kind of come back to the science part of it. Which let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about this extended consciousness paradigm, which you are a part of in your work, and talk about some of the practical applications for that. I mentioned to you recently, and I think on the skeptical forums, that I just completed the book, even though I interviewed the guy a couple months ago, and that's Stephen A. Schwartz's book on The Secret Vaults of Time, and it's a book on archaeology and the use of psychics in archaeology. And the evidence is just pretty overwhelming that some people have the ability to locate buried archaeological sites with their consciousness, with their brain. Are you familiar with any of that work?
I mean, I don't know much about it as far as from a personal sense, but I guess some people kind of equate it to dowsing, which is another form of the paranormal that comes under severe criticism. And that's kind of the hunt, or like alchemy, or the hunt for something, you know, that isn't there by using, you know, psychic powers. And I think that what happens in those situations is they use statistical analysis for, so how many times you're successful and how many times psychics or mediums, whatever, were not successful. And they say, well, if you look at it statistically, I think that the evidence, you know, doesn't really bode well for those psychic and mediums, because it's just by chance. And, you know, so again, it comes down to statistical argument. And I don't have that information, you know, to counter argue it, but I do think it's possible. But the problem with this field is that so many people who are calling themselves psychics or mediums these days are coming at it completely untrained. They're coming at it from an ego need, or they're coming at it from the fact that they just are not skilled in any other kind of profession and want to make money, you know, and this is an easy way to do it. So, again, there's no filtration system from the good and the bad. And that's really an issue also that hurts me in my work is that, you know, there's no, like the way that I apply, the practical application of the work that I do, I have worked in conjunction with other therapists and psychiatrists who send me their clients for a one-time visit. You know, not that I'm trying to take their, because they realize that, you know, this guy's not going to take our clientele away from us. He's actually going to help us in our work move the process along or raise it to another level because of some block that the person has or because they've obsessed about a certain death and they can't get over that, or they're dealing with some kind of addictive habit. And in my work, when other family members that are discarnate come in and they talk about that particular, you know, addiction or habit or block, it somehow allows the person to release it in a way that they hadn't yet achieved in therapy. So the way that I apply it, you know, I see myself as kind of an afterlife therapist, I guess, in some ways. And a lot of the therapy, by the way, I told you this before, a lot of therapy I do is not for just for the client that comes to see me, but for the family members that have gone on. So it's kind of like family counseling. So, you know, that is my main focus of interest for myself. You know, I know that you and I have talked about other applications of it in kind of in the, you know, services industry where you can actually rent yourself out to help people either through, you know, archaeological digs or maybe real estate or financial services or whatever. I have not gone that far yet. You know, it's been put to me as an idea, but at this point, I'm still kind of in the therapeutical stages of my work.
For folks who are interested in a reading from you, can you tell us a little bit about what that process is like? And I do know that that's something that you do, and it is available to people, and you can call up Marcel and get a reading. But what is that like for people?
Well, I do see a lot of people that they themselves call themselves skeptics, and so I think one of the reasons I'm referred to these kind of people is because they know that they're not going to go through the uncomfortable period once they've contacted me of trying to avoid telling me anything, because usually when people contact me through email or through a phone call, it's pretty much deciding, okay, what day and what time are we going to do it? I don't ask them any questions like, well, why are you coming to see me? Is there something in particular that you're looking for? In fact, I try to communicate to them right up front. Like I said before, do not communicate anything to me. I really don't care what your agenda is for seeing me, because your agenda truthfully does not matter in the process. So part of the process of seeing me is basically just showing up. And sometimes people say, is there anything I need to do to prepare for a reading? Should I bring anything? Do I need to bring a photo or something that someone owned? I go, no, just basically show up, make sure that you're dressed, because, you know, I don't like to do readings in the nude. And so basically they come in, they sit down, and I kind of briefly go over the rules of how it is that I work, because, and I'm going to say this now, I don't think I've said it on the radio before, mediumship is a 3-point contact. It's myself, those in spirit, and the person that's sitting before me. And all three of us have to be on the same page. You know, one of us can't be off thinking about paying our bills or what we have to do after the reading, or because it is a group effort here. So I try to get the person that's sitting in front of me focused, and I give them what the rules are, because the way that spirit communicates, and this is one of the main ways, people can call it clairvoyance, can call it clairaudience or clairsentience, any of the things they want to call it. But what truly happens is that if you think about your memory and your knowledge as, you know, for the sake of argument, you know, the metaphor of information files or just like a computer, you know, computer files. And spirit is able to access anything that's in a person's brain as far as memory files. At the same time, they're accessing my memory files. There is a synchronous access going on, and there's a pattern matching going on. So a lot of times what they're doing is only pointing out things that I already have in my frame of reference, whether it's the people I know, places I've been, experiences I've had, relationships, and so on. And what they're doing is they're for the most part, highlighting my own experiences to me and saying there is a correlation between this in your life and something similar in their life. And all the time they're playing these matching games, and then the parts where they don't really fully match, and they kind of jump in and kind of, you know, color it a little bit differently. But so I say this because I want psi researchers, in the way that they construct their experiments or they think about this, is that there is a synchronous access going on and a pattern matching process. And I think it's mathematical. I don't really know the full story of it, but I know that they are saying, Marcel, remember this in your life. There is something similar in that person's life. You know this person that you know whose name is Liz? They know someone named Liz, and it's connected, you know, so they're using me to get to them. So I'm the toolbox.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So back to the cryptographer thing. I mean, that's a very interesting insight into how the thing works. I've never heard it described.
Yeah, because people want to call it, you know, give it all these different names that, you know, I have the power to see, I have the power to smell, I have the power. What it really is you have that power, supposedly, is because someone in discarnate consciousness is poking their finger at it. Not that you have it, is that someone has recalling, uh-huh. They're recalling your memory. So I moved my, you know, critical analytical mind over. I said, okay, whatever you want to use in my brain to recall, go ahead and do it, because I know that's how they work. They recall my memory, and they give me a sense that is connected to the person sitting in front of me. So that's, wow. You know, that's how it works.
Wow, that's a lot to absorb. I'm glad I don't have your job. So hey, so tell us lastly, and we'll see if this makes it on the air, if I've done my job here. But I don't think we should kind of wrap this up without talking about the show on which this interview is going to air, Afterlife FM. Can you tell folks a little bit about what's going on with Afterlife FM and what they can expect to hear in the near future?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. There are going to be some changes around here. My goal originally, and I tried this before on the show that I did previously as well, is to inject a little bit of humor and a little bit of kind of silliness and, you know, nonsense sometimes into the conversation of survival of consciousness and mediumship and the research and stuff like that. And I've tried to bring two groups together, which was those who are, you know, like yourself and like your listeners, interested in the research science part of it. And also, there's a lot of people out there who are into getting the readings or may consider themselves, you know, seekers or new agers or whatever they are, and get them to kind of...
Just want some help in their life right now,
right,
kind of thing.
Right, and I wanted to get those two people together, and so they get to know each other in some way, like, you know... Maybe people shouldn't be all scientific about it, and they should kind of look at it from the personal, you know, subjective part of it, as some of these other people do. And then the other people should actually try to apply the scientific method or be a little bit more skeptical in the way they approach, right. You know, the subject. Anyways, it hasn't really worked out perfectly because these two groups really don't blend well together. And they don't really have – there's so many distractions in life to sit – down and listen to my show for an hour and try to get your part of it and wait for the other guy to be through is, you know. So what I'm going to do now, I think I'm going to steer away from the live call-in part of the show and basically present the subject matter the way that I see it or feel it that week. I'm not going to try to make everyone happy anymore. And I also want to bring back some of the poetry and some of the awe that one experiences in life, even when they don't even know why they're experiencing, because you can experience awe and poetry in life, for instance, through music or through writing or whatever, and it awakens a spiritual sense in you, and it doesn't have to be, you know, called God, or it doesn't have to be called religion, or it doesn't have to be called spirit. There is a sense of poetry and magic that we can experience in life without knowing its origins. And I want to be able to bring some of that back into the show because I think I've lost it. And so I'm excited about Afterlife FM, you know, hopefully in the coming weeks. And again, you know, the audience always knows. So I'll see what the audience says and see if the listeners keep coming back. And just like any other rating systems, if after a few weeks or months or so that, I'm proved wrong, that nobody really wants to hear me talk at all, then I'll just sign off with a smile and take all the memories with me.
Well, that's awesome. That's great. Well, that's really something to look forward to on Afterlife FM, and it sounds interesting. I'm intrigued to see where the
where the poetry will lead.
Well, the first show that I have coming up, I think that I'm going to attempt this on. I don't know if you're familiar with the musician poet Nick Drake, who is a British musician. It's part of a series that I'm going to be doing called Afterlife Heroes. These are people who, in their own lifetime, did not achieve either the success or fame that they possibly sought, but have developed kind of a cult following and a huge influence on people, you know, posthumously. So Nick Drake, if you don't know who he is and don't know his music or his story, you should definitely look him up on Google and find out more about him, because he possesses a magic that has touched people almost since the time that he died, and his cult following is huge. Not so huge in the United States as it is in other countries, but it's pretty big in this country as well. And then I also have another gentleman who I'm going to be including in the series, and someone who I know a little bit more, I'm a little bit more familiar with, and that's Dan Eldon, who was a photojournalist who was killed in 1993 in Somalia. And he has an incredible influence on young people today from the afterlife, and he has an incredible following all over the world. It's global. It's amazing. And I am friends with his family, and I am going to be interviewing them as well. So I'm looking forward to that part, and that will bring the poetry and some of the awe and wonder back into the show.
Great, great. Well, that certainly sounds exciting, Marcel, and it's been very interesting talking to you today. I have to say, I learned, as always, that's the great thing for me in these dialogues I have. I always come away learning something, and I've learned so much about the way you do your work and maybe about the process that might lie behind what's really involved in what you do. So thanks for letting me do this. It's been a lot of fun.
Alex, actually, I wasn't sure what was going to happen today, but you are, like I said before, and I know you don't like this moniker, but you are the voice of consciousness. And you somehow, with your little vocal magic, bring out the best in people. And you've done it on your show, and now look what you've done. You've done it on my show. You've pushed me up a level here now. I got to kind of live up to this reputation now that you've brought me to. But I do want to say, I want to reiterate, you know, I know you're going to be talking to James Randi soon, and I've posted myself on your own forum that I do, honestly, although it's against kind of the nature of who I am, who have been maybe in the past, because I am a little bit confrontational in some of the things that I do, but I am dreaming of and looking forward to a day when the psi community and the skeptical community can work together in a non-adversarial way, and you know, whether it doesn't have to be for $1 million, it can be just for the sake of research or understanding or knowledge. And I hope that maybe before James Randi goes off to the other side, that he may also come to see that as something valuable. And I don't know if that's going to be possible or not, because, you know, some people are committed to their paradigm, as they would also claim of myself. But I'm saying, if opensourcescience.net can make it happen, I'll be there.
Great, great. Well, we'll see, Marcel, and we'll certainly look forward to the new relaunch, if you will, of Afterlife FM. It sounds exciting, and it's amazing how true to the name it sounds. So maybe you came up with the name before you really figured out the true format of the show. So that's exciting.
I'm not afraid to get my face muddy.
Yeah, that's what it takes. I'm with you there. Email me and say, hey, you know, how did you start this show, or Skeptico or whatever? And it's like, hey, just jump in and not be afraid to get whacked around a little bit.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for being on my show and for being my guest interviewer. And I hope that, you know, at some point or another, we can do something similar again or have some more fun, or at least let the people know about some collaborative effort that, you know, we're undertaking together.
Great. I'm sure we will, Marcel.
Okay. Take care. Have a great day.
Thanks to Marcel for joining me here today. If you'd like links to the Afterlife FM show that he hosts, or if you'd like to learn more about Skeptico or our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You'll find all our old shows in the archives, an email link where you can drop me a note or a voicemail, and also our forums where you can engage in dialogue with other Skeptico listeners and leave us your thoughts, opinions, and ideas on the show and other topics that come up for Skeptico listeners. Next week, as promised, James Randi, very interesting chat. stay with me for that. Until then, bye for now.